All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Ashley. Just say welcome to those tuned into the webcast as well. Mr. Wilhelm's message would have gone perfectly right after the one that I'm about to give. So just remember what he said earlier. And about 15 years ago, I set out on a journey. A journey called marriage. Now, I had a plan in place. I knew exactly what kind of a husband I was going to be, just how perfect it would be. And if you were to talk to my wife, and I'd prefer if you didn't, you'll find out that I was not the natural-born husband that I thought I was going to be or that I set out to be. And even now, after 15 years, I think I've almost achieved the level of tolerable. Well, about 2 years ago, Sandra and I were doing a Passover Bible study with some friends of ours, and it led into a deep discussion about the marriage to the Lamb, which then led me to a study of marriage. And I was amazed at how much is in the Scripture about marriage, things that I hadn't even thought of that teach us about marriage and that marriage teaches us. Think about the fruits of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. All of these things are marriage topics. Marriage teaches us how two can become one. If we didn't have that, we might come up with some theory that says that, I don't know, God, the Father, and the Holy Spirit are all one and the same. Or we might come up with some theory that says that Jesus Christ was a piece of God that broke off and came down to earth. But we have marriage so we can understand how two can become one. So many things in Scripture, so many examples. It's funny now because I remember when we were setting the date for our wedding, in order for Sandra's uncle to be able to come, we had to have the wedding on Sabbath so that he could drive home on Sunday and be back to work on Monday. So I went to Mr. Neff and I said, hey, is it okay if we do our wedding on Sabbath? And he said, well, yeah, of course it is. There's a lot of spiritual lessons and things involving marriage. And I was like, oh, okay. No clue. A normal person, that would have made me think, hey, I don't know what he meant by that. I should look into that, but not me. I mean, I had a plan, remember? So 13 years later, I decided I needed to study this. Now, obviously, I can't cover the topic of marriage in one sermon. It's not possible. So today, what I would like to do is to focus on an introduction to marriage and the marriage of the children of Israel to Christ. If you'd like a title, the title is Marriage, a Story of Life. So to begin the story, we have to go all the way back to creation. God created the heavens and the earth, the sea and the dry land, the sun, the moon, the stars. And he looked on it all and said it was good. And let's pick up the story in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God creates man. And man is in this beautiful garden, and he's naming everything, and he's taking care of everything and tending to it. But there's just something missing. Just another chapter over, Genesis 2, verse 21. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and he slept. And he took his prime rib and closed up the flesh in its place. That was a joke. Then the rib which the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into woman, and he brought her to the man. So woman is created. Now, she's not created exactly like the man. It wasn't a clone of the man. She's different, but she's comparable to the man. She's compatible with the man. And she must have looked really good, because Adam continues on and says, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man." Verse 24, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they two shall become one flesh." So what we see here is the very definition of marriage. One man, one woman, one flesh. In the world we live in today, we are seeing an attack on that definition of marriage. We are seeing an attack on marriage in general. The number of people getting married now is down so much because they're just moving in together, living together. There's no sense in getting married anymore because of the attack on what God instituted as the marriage. So for just a moment, everything was perfect. God, man, and woman were all dwelling together in the garden. God's plan was in action, the plan he had had from the very beginning. Unfortunately, this plan would not last long, because the last sin would enter into the picture. And sin separates man from God. How did sin enter the picture? Sin entered the picture the exact way it always does. Genesis chapter 3, beginning in verse 6. "So when the woman saw the tree was good for food, and it was pleasant to the eyes," lust of the eyes, "and desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate," lust of the flesh. "Then the eyes of both of them were open, and they knew they were naked," pride of life. Man had become ashamed of God's creation. And we see that when we compare Genesis 2:25 and Genesis 3, verse 10. 2:25 says they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Chapter 3, verse 10 says, "I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked." Man had become ashamed of God's creation. So sin had entered, and man was separated from God. Now let's think for just a minute. How many marriages have fallen apart? Or how many arguments between spouses, if you broke it right down to the root cause, was nothing other than lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, and the pride of life? If we can remember how this happens, we can prevent a lot of those problems that occur. So as we go through this story, we're going to have to use a time machine, because we're going to cover a long period of time. So now we're going to go ahead and get in our time machine, and we're going to leave the Garden of Eden, because there's no one here anyway, because they've been sent out because they were separated from God. But as we travel to our next stop, let's take a moment and remember what God's original plan was. God's original plan was to have a people that looked like him, that would, of their own free will, love, honor, and obey him. All right, so now we've arrived at our next stop. We'll get out and look around here and see that we've landed in Genesis chapter 12, and we'll begin in verse 1. "Now the Lord said to Abraham," oh, there's a clue, we are in Abraham's country. "The Lord said to Abraham, 'Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation, I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" So this is the event where God calls Abraham from his father's house, from his kindred, from everything that he knew, and sends him off to a foreign land, but not just any foreign land. This would be the land that God would give to Abraham and to his descendants. What we're seeing here is God is calling a new people. God has a new plan in place, still much like the original plan, but that didn't work in the garden, so now he has a new way he's going to go about it. Now, Abraham had many, many good qualities, but the one that stands out to me the most is trust. When God said it, he believed it, even when it made no humanistic sense whatsoever. Like when he said to Sarah she would have a son at 90 years old. That shouldn't even be possible. But Abraham doesn't even blink. He just, God said it, he believed it. And I guess that's why when Abraham's time was getting close, God revealed the full plan to Abraham. Let's turn over to Genesis chapter 15 and we'll pick it up in verse 13. Genesis chapter 15 and verse 13 says, "Then he said to Abraham, 'Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them and will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete.'" So what we see here is God's full plan for what's coming up later on. And he wanted Abraham to know, hey, I didn't just give you this promise in vain. This is how this is going to play out. Now, lucky for us, we don't have to wait four generations because we have our time machine. So we're going to get back in our time machine and travel again. And as we're traveling this time, I'm going to take a moment here and put into context just how a betrothal process would look at the time of the Hebrews. It's not exactly like we do it today where a guy drops to a knee with a ring, she cries and says yes. It looked a whole lot different back then. First of all, there would be an introduction of some sort. It might be a well-known or well-off family has a son, or it could be that the son does something amazing or great and becomes known. Or it could be a damsel in distress type of scene, which is what we find over in Exodus chapter 2. Exodus chapter 2, verse 16. "Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock." When they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "How is it you have come so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and he also drew enough water for us and watered the flock." So he said to his daughters, "And where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." So Moses goes and eats bread, and the next thing he knows, he's married. So there was an introduction that took place. Something that made Moses stand out to the father of the bride. For the next part, there would be a proposal. And the proposal might look something like this. A young man and his father are walking down a dusty road to a nearby village. Both are silent, lost in thought. The father steps boldly forward as he confidently rehearses how to negotiate. The son walks a little nervously, with butterflies in his stomach, because tonight he will ask a beautiful young lady to be his wife. Upon arrival at the house, they are greeted by a servant who would wash their feet and then present them to the master of the house. And after an exchange of pleasantries, the two fathers would enter the main part of the house to negotiate the bride price. The father of the bride wants as much as he can get for his daughter, while the father of the groom wants to pay as little as possible to get the daughter for his son. Now, he has to be extremely careful about this, because if he offers too little, that would be considered an insult, and that can be deadly. So as they are negotiating in the other room, the bride might say something to the son like, "What have you been up to?" At this point, the son would begin to describe a room that he's been building. And he would describe the intricate stonework. He would make her see how beautiful this room was going to be. And at last, an agreement would be reached between the two fathers, and it would be time to eat. Now, this would be a very special meal. It would be served with lamb, maybe herbs. They would break bread together, and at last the son would stand. He would rise from the table, and he would pour wine into a cup, take a drink, and hand it to the young lady. The young lady would take the cup and pause for just a moment to consider the ramifications of what this means. Because you see, this action is a statement. This action says, "My life for yours, and your life for mine." Everything she knew is about to change. She'll be leaving her father's house. She'll be going to the son's house to be his wife. Now, it's very important to note at this point that even in this society, the daughter had the option to set the cup down and refuse the offer. Or she could drink from the cup, and that would mean that she was officially engaged to the son. I don't think that when young people get engaged, that they consider how deep of a commitment this is. I don't think they consider that it means that your life is going to change forever. It will never be the same. And that's not a bad thing. I can tell you after 15 years of marriage, it's a great thing. But it's a thing. And it's something that you have to prepare yourself for and be ready for. So with that context in mind, let's step out of the time machine and see where we have arrived. I see a river and green. It looks to me like the land of Goshen. We must be in Egypt. Well, now that we've arrived in Egypt, we have found out that Abraham is long gone. We're four generations down the road, and a new king has risen up over Egypt. A king that did not know Joseph, did not know how he had saved the entire country from complete and total destruction, and he has made the children of Israel slaves. Now, in this day and age, Pharaoh had one job. His job was to maintain order in Egypt. He was a god to the Egyptians. They considered him a god. And it was his job to maintain order between the Egyptians and all the other gods. And you remember the story. They had the sun god, the Nile god, the fly god, all of the 10 gods that got attacked. If you'll remember, I think it was last year, Mr. Ashley did a full series on each plague and which god it attacked and destroyed. So all of the people are terrified of getting out of line and disturbing the order because of the threat of Pharaoh or one of the other gods. So he has this control and this fear factor that keeps everyone in line, and that is what Pharaoh's place is in Egypt. So when Pharaoh looks out towards the land of Goshen and he sees this people that's not Egyptian that are now mightier in number and greater than the Egyptians, in his mind, this is out of order. This doesn't work. This could be a big problem. So what is he going to do? Well, first he tries to work the children of Israel to death. And he figures out, well, that didn't work. So then he goes to the midwives and he says, "You murder every single baby boy that is born." Fortunately, that didn't work either. So we're going to pick up the story in Exodus chapter 2 and verse 23. Exodus chapter 2 and verse 23. "Now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage." Now, what is missing from this verse? It happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out. What's missing here is to God. In Mr. Wilhelm's sermonette, he told Joshua told of when the children of Israel saw the Egyptians coming, and what did he say? They cried out to the Lord. That's part of the phrase. But in here, we don't see it as part of the phrase. They had been in Egypt so long. They had gotten so comfortable that they had forgotten God. They didn't know who they were crying out to. They just cried out. Remember, Pharaoh had given Joseph the very best of the land of Egypt. The land of Goshen was the best there was. Full of grass for their flocks and herds. It had water. And so what happened? They got comfortable. And when people get comfortable, they forget God. Case in point, the country we live in today. Continuing on in verse 24, "So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And he looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them." See, God doesn't forget. And God looked down at what was happening on the children of Israel, and he said, "It's almost time." Now remember back in the context, we said we needed to have an introduction, right? So we need someone to introduce God to the children of Israel. Now, this can't just be anyone, because this person has to take Pharaoh one-on-one. So this is going to have to be someone very special, someone that is a prophet to the children of Israel, but a god to Egypt. Well, God already had that one handled. How about someone who was born a Levite, but was raised in Pharaoh's house? Of course, we're talking about Moses. Moses was born in Pharaoh's house. He was raised in Pharaoh's house, but instead of living a life of luxury, lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, he chose slavery, and he went back to his people when he was grown. Now, Moses was spared by Pharaoh's daughter. She pulled him out of the river, and once he was weaned, he went to Pharaoh's house. So he has an intimate knowledge of how Pharaoh works, an intimate knowledge of how order is maintained. So God calls Moses at the burning bush, and he says, "Moses, I want you to introduce me to the children of Israel. I want you to make that introduction." Now, Moses, for some reason, is a little leery of doing this. And I guess we can understand why, because taking on Pharaoh is no small task. And being born in Pharaoh's or raised in Pharaoh's house, Moses would have seen people die for trying to take on Pharaoh. But God gives him signs and assures him, "I'll be with you." But you can't have an introduction without a name, can you? So Moses says, "What name do I tell him?" So let's pick up the story in Exodus chapter 3, beginning in verse 13. "Then Moses said to God, 'Indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say, the God of your fathers has sent me, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent you. There's so much meaning in that name. It's so simple and yet so complex. I am. I always was. I always will be. It's the perfect name. So if any sacred namers are listening to this, I just solved the mystery. You're welcome. So now we have a name, but Moses isn't quite ready yet. He's concerned about his speaking capability. Apparently, they didn't have speech class at Pharaoh University when he was there. So God assigns Aaron to be a spokesman. And it ends up working out perfect because now when Pharaoh sees them coming, he sees the God and his prophet, and it makes a more convincing approach. As it says over here in chapter 7, verse 1, Exodus chapter 7, verse 1, so the Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of the land. So Moses goes, as he's told, and he introduces God to the children of Israel. And God is showing Israel and Pharaoh his power as he plagues God after God after God, who thought they were powerful, who thought they could do something. And God shows them who is really powerful. Over the whole land of Egypt, this is happening, including where the children of Israel are. Talk about an introduction. Someone that could see the power of God firsthand. But that's going to change. Let's turn over to chapter 8, Exodus chapter 8, and we'll begin in verse 22. It says, in that day I will set apart the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell, that no swarms of flies shall be there, in order that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the land. I will make a difference between my people and your people. Tomorrow this sign shall be. And the Lord did so. Thick swarms of flies came into the house of Pharaoh, into his servant's house, and into all the land of Egypt. The land was corrupted because of the swarms of flies. If you'll remember when we discussed this, when Mr. Ashley did that series, when we say flies, we're not talking about house flies like I have at my house. We're talking about a thing like a dung beetle that would have been about that big. When we were at the feast in Utah, we went to a museum and they had some on a pin board. And the average ones were about like this, but they had some that I kid you not were that big. Can you imagine a swarm of these flies with prickly claws on their ends of their feet and sharp, it was almost like an antenna looking thing sticking out. I mean, it was eerie to think about this scripture and look at how big these flies were. So God separated his people from the rest of Egypt. And that concludes the introduction. I think God has been thoroughly introduced. So the next thing we talked about in the context was a bride price. How about all the riches that you can handle from the land of Egypt? An inheritance, a land flowing with milk and honey, but even more importantly, freedom and life. So then the moment of truth would happen. A meal was set forth. The lamb was prepared, the herbs were cooked, and the blood went on the doorposts and on the lintel. Again, another symbol that says, my life for yours and your life for mine. Very literally in this case, because if it wasn't there, the firstborn in that house would die. And as we know, losing every single firstborn in the entire land did not set well with the Egyptians. And the children of Israel are forced out of the land of Egypt, just as God had promised. They are given all of the riches of the land of Egypt. and they journey from Ramses to Succoth. Now, there's a real easy route, if you look at that red line right there, that would take them straight into the promised land. But God wasn't quite done with Egypt just yet. And there is a lesson for all of us as he leads them into the wilderness and right to the edge of the Red Sea. Now let's pause and think about this for a moment. These people have spent their lives serving Pharaoh with rigor. They've watched their babies be killed. And this moment, as they stand on the shore of the Red Sea, they are free. But in the distance behind them, they see a big dust cloud as Pharaoh's chariots are coming toward them rapidly. And God says, I am bigger than the Red Sea. I can give you rest. I can give you peace. Just trust me. What was or what is your Red Sea? Is it a career? Is it school? It could be drugs, alcohol, pornography. See, we can all look at this world and we know that it is certain death. The chariots are coming. We can see it. God says, what are you going to do? Will you come to me? Will you trust me? Will you be mine and me yours? He says, come into the water. Be washed. Come to me, and I will give you life. Now, I don't mean to stand up here and sound like a Sunday morning preacher that says, you know, just accept Christ and send me some money, and I promise you, your life will be perfect from now on. Because it doesn't work that way. I'm not telling you that your life is going to be perfect. Because guess what? No marriage is. There's always some issues. There's always some things that have to be worked through. This is just another lesson that we learned from marriage. Is that following God is not always going to be a cakewalk. It's not always going to be sunshine and roses. Sometimes there's going to be difficulties. Sometimes there's going to be trials. But God promises us life and peace if we accept it. So if there's any young people out there on the webcast, what will you choose? You're going to have to make that choice for yourself at some point in time of whether you will choose lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Or will you choose life eternal? So we continue on. And God parted the waters for the children of Israel. And they walked into the sea on dry ground, but yet submerged as they went between walls of water. It's a picture of baptism. They had chosen God over death. So they journey to Mount Sinai. And we're going to stop here and take another look at context again. And what would a traditional Hebrew wedding look like? Well, the first thing that would happen is the bride would purify herself, what's called a mikvah. And then a ketuvah, or a wedding contract, would be written. It would look something like this. And then at last there would be a huppah, or what's called a marriage canopy, would be set up, and it'd be set up kind of in a high place so that where the bride and groom could walk to there and everyone else would be down and look around. Multiple purposes for that. One, it was so that everybody could see, but two, it was also that they could hear what was being said. So the bride and the groom and the minister would all walk up and stand under the huppah, and the ketuvah, the marriage contract, would be read aloud. And they would exchange rings, and the groom would say, "Behold, by this ring you are consecrated to me as my wife, according to the law of Moses and Israel." And then as everyone went down to the feast, the couple would spend a moment alone together, and then they too would come down and proceed to the feast. So with that context in mind, let's take a walk through the events of Mount Sinai. And we'll turn over to Exodus chapter 19, and we'll pick it up in verse 3. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special people, a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." So what is God saying here? He says, "I love you. You are my bride. Of all the people in the whole world, I choose you to be mine." Continuing on in verse 8, "Then all the people answered together and said, 'All that the Lord has spoken, we will do.' So Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord." Does that sound familiar? It's exactly what I said when I got married. I do. Let's continue on in verse 10. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow.'" Remember, we talked about the mikvah. "And let them be ready on the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people." So he's telling them, consecrate yourselves for the wedding. He specifically says, wash your clothes and bathe. This is a traditional mikvah. Continuing on in verse 16, "Then it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the trumpet was very loud, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was completely in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly." Just picture what this must have looked like to the children of Israel. They're down here, and they look up, and the whole mountain is covered in smoke. It looks like a huppah. It looks like what someone would get married under, only much bigger. And so Moses goes up, and God comes down, and they stand together under the huppah. Then the very next thing that happens is the wedding contract is read. Exodus chapter 20, the Ten Commandments. What are the Ten Commandments? We all know it very well. Love toward God, love toward neighbor. I'm not going to read all of the Ten Commandments from the text, but because we know them. But let's listen to them from a slightly different perspective. Number one, I am your husband. You can't have any other lover. Number two, not even any pictures or images of another lover. Number three, don't take my name in vain. Actually, let's read that one. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 7. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Is it possible that we've been reading this wrong all along? See, when I got married, my wife took my name. It's a pretty common practice. Is it possible that God is saying to the children of Israel, when you take my name, your actions and your behavior should reflect who you are now and who you represent? Don't take my name in vain. Number four, let's have a day that is just for us to spend time together. Or there's another way we could look at this. Exodus chapter 31, verse 16. Actually, beginning in verse 15. Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh is the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Therefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. Verse 17 says, it is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. Just as the ring is a sign of someone who is married, the Sabbath is a sign between God and his people. And it works too, doesn't it? People who keep the Sabbath are noticed. When you don't go to the game because it's the Sabbath, people notice. When you don't go to the party on Friday night, people notice. It is a sign between us and God of the covenant, the marriage covenant. And the rest of the commandments are love toward neighbor. The children of Israel are all together at Mount Sinai, just them. There's no one else around. God says, don't murder each other. Don't commit adultery with each other. Don't steal from each other. Don't lie about each other. Don't covet one another. Because in so doing, you're doing it to my bride. Now, mainstream Christianity wants you to think that the law is harsh. The Ten Commandments makes it difficult, that it limits what you're able to do. But in reality, it's just a wedding contract. Think about your marriage. And if you're not married, think about what you would like your marriage to be. I think the Ten Commandments makes a pretty good outline of what a happy marriage would look like. Well, brethren, this story is far from over. This is a look at the definition of marriage and the calling of the children of Israel and the wedding of Christ and his people. This is just a glimpse of the past. We still have the present and the future to talk about. But for now, we'll leave the children of Israel and Jesus Christ at Mount Sinai, and we'll get back in our time machine and come back home. But as we travel back home, let's remember the wedding contract and the words that God said to his people then and now. I love you. Come to me. My life for yours, and your life for mine.